Willemsen, the chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Honourable Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you. Our organisation is the Large Non-Bank Lender Association. It's not a very creative name, I must confess, but what we try to say is that we're bigger than Mr. Ferreira's typical lenders, members that he represents, and we're smaller than the banks, and therefore, to some extent, we don't fit in anywhere. So we felt necessary to have, there's a need for representation of our members, and hence we established the organization some 3-4 years ago. Our members, as you can see there, Sun and Personal Loans, or include Sun and Personal Loans, Bayport, Old Mutual Finance, Real People, Home Choice, RCS. We provide unsecured loans. Some of us do developmental credit, and others is more in the facility business. And we've got a combined book of $32 billion. What is interesting is that we came to testify on the proposed bill in 2016. And when I looked at the numbers again, it seems like our collective book hasn't grown. So if anything, there is a stabilization in the market. I must say, before I get onto the issues, because this may look like a list of complaints, I think what I want to say is we do have appreciation for the work that has been done by the committee. We do understand the need for intervention, and I think the issue is really around what kind of instrument and on what basis poor people should be assisted where they can't afford. We don't believe in a prison sentence. We'd like to see our clients being rehabilitated and coming back into the industry. So, but we do have issues with the proposed bill. We have not, and I'll confess, and I'll apologize for that, but we haven't been working as closely as probably we should have. But we are willing to contribute and to make constructive proposals on the way forward. The issues that we will address in more detail, and I must say also, Chair, I don't know how it happened that we're on this time on the agenda, but there's some blessings in that a lot of people spoke before us and made some points very eloquently. The only risk I have at this point is that I may be boring because there is a lot of repetition. But we will deal with the criteria for debt intervention. We will deal with the effect of the bill. We will deal to a lesser extent with the constitutional issues. We believe that has been well covered. There's a process issue. There's an issue of balance. Credit life has come up. We may want to add to that a bit. The complexity of the determination of reckless lending is something which has not been addressed. I think Mr. Slot actually said the opposite the day before, so I want to spend some time on that. We need to also discuss communication and information issues, and then the well-known issue of criminalization, which I won't dwell on too much. I think the first point that has been made is that the criteria for debt intervention is not clear. Now, if you look at the outcome of this for a credit provider is quite significant. As you've heard, assets are effectively sterilized or extinguished in the end. So at least we would like to see the circumstances under which such orders can be given, the circumstances under which somebody can apply, to be very clear. And because I think it comes, you know, I just wonder how somebody like the National Credit Regulator would make a determination to suspend, on what basis a court would, or the tribunal would rule on it if the criteria are not clear. And I think that, again, plays into the whole constitutional issue. Because of that, the fact that it's not so clear, it just makes it more of a threat. I think another thing there that is, maybe I can just add to that, and I'm sticking my neck out, but I think, you know, to some extent, the criteria need to be almost more difficult than the case of over-indebtedness, because the impact here is more severe. in the case of where a person goes into debt, debt review, in that situation, at least you can expect that he is going to pay something back to you. That's the expectation. Where in this case, in all likelihood, the person is never going to come out of this process, and you may, in the end, the debt is going to be extinguished. So you would expect, you know, almost a situation not where somebody just can't pay his debt in the timeliest fashion, but where there's almost clarity that he will never be able to get out of his debt. So I would propose a more stringent test, and I haven't really thought about how to formulate it, but I would suggest at least you need to have criteria. So, the point is that it doesn't state that the applicant needs to be over-indebted, he doesn't need to make out a case for that, and that we regret. The other concern is, of course, that all of this can happen. There could be intervention whilst the credit provider needs not have been reckless, and we'll deal with that later on. But we do feel that the effect of what the orders that are imposed are quite severe for somebody who's actually have been playing by the rules. So we think that there should be reconsideration of that. So when you deal with the effect, there hasn't been much said about systemic risk. And I mean, that the reason is probably that it depends upon the extent of, you know, how wide you open this for. If you open it beyond 50,000, you open it, you know, for people earning more than 7.5, then you're obviously also increasing the risk of the systemic risk. And what we mean by that is simply that if for every loan that there's a chance that you, there may be not repayment on that loan, you need to make impairments. I don't know what extent you've heard about, there's been any testimony around the impact of provisions and how that should be done, but when you need to make provisions, that's probably one of the biggest impacts on your income statement. It affects your sustainability, it affects your profits. And of course, most of the lenders that are our members, they're not just sitting there with big pockets, they actually need to borrow money to on-lend. So they need to repay those loans. And if they can't repay that, that's got a ripple effect through the economy. So it's really a question of how wide the net is going to be defined. Then on consumers, what is the effect going to be on consumers? I've said the segment is now stigmatized. And that is not, again, it's not, as we heard this morning, it's not a threat, it's a reality that lenders will tend to avoid risk and will look at where they can optimize their returns. So the real impact of this legislation is that that group of borrowers falling within those definitions will probably be sidelined, will find it more difficult to get access to credit, and may be excluded. And that for me is quite sad because I spend a lot of time in my personal life working on access to credit and financial inclusion, and I see this is actually going in the opposite direction. The constitutional issues I don't want to dwell on enough. I can't do better than the senior counsel that you've heard for BASA today. I think you dealt with it very eloquently. But our concern particularly is the ongoing future declarations. It's a situation where you're invited to go and play in a particular field, but once you're there, then after the fact you find out that you shouldn't have been there. So it makes it very difficult for you to price, it makes it difficult for you to manage your risk. Credit providers like to know they will only go where they can manage your risk. And if there's uncertainty, it makes it more difficult and they price more expensively. So you've asked the question of BASA to say, how should that consultation then be done before there is a declaration? And I would submit it's not about the consultation. It's the fact that when there's a substantial declaration which impact property and people's assets, then it must come back to Parliament. It should be an amendment to this bill. If the scope of this bill needs to be amended, it shouldn't be by way of regulation. It should be by way of law. The other point, last one, is access to courts. That point has been made. We lenders, to a large extent, passive. Once there is a referral, The NCR makes it a determination which leads to suspension, and it's not so clear at what station, to what extent the credit provider can come to the party and actually be part of the process. So in some or other way, there needs to be a way for the lender at a very early stage to respond. My personal experience being that there has been challenges on reckless lending, and whenever you show the facts and to actually roll out all the documentation, people come back and accept that it wasn't reckless. So we've got to be very careful not to get have a loan, whole lot of loans landing up with the tribunal, and then it's proven not to be reckless. Or, well, not only has it only got to deal with reckless lending, but I think the point is made. Process, credit providers excluded, we're concerned about that. There's a number of tests in the draft bill which are fairly subjective. It talks about reasonable suspicions, and if you got that reasonable suspicion wrong, you may then it's a criminal offence. For instance, if you look at your peers, if you have the luxury to look at your peers' assessment and the loans that they've granted, which is almost impossible, the requirement there is a reasonable suspicion that you must have before you refer it, and if you don't have that, then or you get it wrong, it's a criminal offence. So that subjectivity creates a problem. And then we think that there need to be some timelines built into the bill for how long it should take for certain people, for the regulator to make a determination. And we'd like to see the tribunal also making certain decisions within certain timelines. I think a lot of people already spoke today about the need for balance, that to some extent this is the legislation is not fair to credit providers, whereas the NCA initially tried to have that balance set out. And I think it's really around issues like, you know, the opportunity that credit providers can have to be part of the process, to oppose it, and I think that is one of the particular issues. The other one is, of course, that credit provider could be perfectly compliant, could be very risk averse, could be have hundreds of compliance officers doing compliant loans, but still end up having to write off money because of an intervention. Credit life has just been capped. We had a difficult time at that time explaining the value of credit life. And now it seems to be proposed that there should be compulsory credit life. For a number of our members, that is a problem because they may be lending to consumers who are not necessarily poor, but who may fall within the 7,000 gross income level, but they may have assets, maybe retired people. So in that case, there's probably no need to have credit life, obligatory credit life. So in those cases, so I think the need for compulsory credit life is challenged. We believe that should be at the discretion of the credit provider. And then the suggestion seems to be that the premiums for this group will now be capped at the lower level, which is really not, I think, possible, because you're actually dealing with a more riskier segment of the market. So I think an insurance company would be loath to provide credit insurance for a more riskier segment at a premium which is lower than what is currently the cap. I want to speak about a bit about the complexity of determining reckless lending. As I said, I don't think it's that easy. We must bear in mind that credit bureau information is not real-time information. There's always a time gap. And credit bureau information is also not perfectly clear. It's something that needs to be interpreted. And let me use a simple example. You may sit with a credit life report which shows an amount of 800 Rand, you know, being there for the last 10 months, but if you've been around a while, you will know that that's just because the bureau has not been updated, the particular credit provider hasn't made the updates. So you're sitting with a situation where, unfortunately, you've got to make a call. So either you're going to ignore that, or to your detriment, you must say to the client, sorry, we can't lend to you. So credit providers have their own models, in the way in which they look at this, and some of them take the risk and some of them not, but nothing of that is illegal. It's a risk assessment, and what I'm saying is within the interpretation of credible information there's a lot of assumptions. And one way in which this could be improved upon is to actually provide more clarity through regulation on the interpretation of credit bureau information. So again, the point that was made earlier, that if a credit provider will not have the information that the credit provider had granted the loan before him at the time, he won't have the same information. Capacity issues. You know, I would hate to be in a situation where a young lawyer gets appointed at the regulator, who is now going to make an assessment as to whether one of my members' loans have been granted recklessly. You know, it may be a young lawyer like me, when I started in this industry, I didn't know what the credit report looked like. I wouldn't have known how to interpret it. There needs to be at least substantial training to make sure that people know what a credit bureau report looks like and how to interpret it, and that you won't get it at university. Certainly I didn't get it when I was at university. So I think we need to specify qualifications and expertise for making those determinations. We mentioned here concerns about the capacity.
Could you just be more specific, because the points you're raising are not the same as others totally. You're putting a different angle in, which is constructive. So when you talk about qualification and expertise or experience, what are we looking at here? 20 years, 10 years, you know, you're also here to make constructive suggestions. You've looked at it, you've identified this as a problem. And as you say, when you were young, so how many years did it take you to become more, have this expertise? 10 years? I don't know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's, I accept the criticism. I think it's difficult, of course, to engage at that level of detail, but I think there need to be courses at least to explain, you know, even as a regulator, and I'm not a critic of the regulator. I think it's very necessary that people that will be appointed to do this kind of assessment should have thorough training. So somebody's got to come and present to them. And I can't say whether it will be 3 months or whether it's 6 months, but there need to be some form of training by experts in credit bureaus or credit bureau information to explain what the kind of anomalies are that you could have there. But, I mean, there would be training, specialists would be much better to comment on that. And then I think it's also just a question. We must appreciate that I think the NCR will have to appoint a lot of people to fulfill this gap. I think certainly there's going to be a lot of people coming through, a lot of applications coming through. So there will be capacity constraints. And it's more a question of more people rather than anything else. And the money, obviously, to do with it. Chair, then this is more perhaps a side issue, but we are approaching the effectiveness of POPIA legislation. So we are a bit concerned about credit bureau information or clients' information floating around by email. If we learned anything from debt counseling, it was that you had to introduce systems to make it work.
Sorry, what does POPIA stand for?
Madam Chair, it's the Protection of Personal Information Act. So I think what we've learned from debt counselling is that it only started working, and I'm one of those who tend to believe that it does work relatively well, that we only started working when systems were introduced to support it, to make the calculations, to handle communication, and so forth. So I can only really see something like this happening when there is proper systems to support it. I believe the same point was made by the credit bureau groupings yesterday. So I think we're saying the same thing. But on criminalisation, to my view is, and I must say I haven't looked at this in all the detail that I probably should have, but my sense is that the prohibitions in the National Credit Act and what is now criminalised overlap, so I don't see that there's a need for it except an attempt to make directors liable, which is a very uncomfortable position to be if you're a director, because you can't know everything. And I think somewhere here on one of these slides I've made a spelling mistake. Now, if that was a reckless loan, I would have had a problem. But where, you know, there could be hundreds of other things that I've spelled correctly over the years, thousands of them. So I think the only point I want to make is that the attempt to make directors liable, I think you've already got the prudential provisions in the Companies Act, and you've already got substantive provisions in the National Credit Act, which deals with probative conduct. So I don't think there's a need for it, but I'm happy to look into that in more detail. I think the only point that we must be clear about is that that obviously cannot be retrospective. We can't look back now. This is going forward, so I think that just needs to be clear and understood. So what are we asking for? I think we're asking for criteria to be clear and to be strict. I think the other underlying concern is that I've seen consumers being granted money who never had the intention to repay. I came to visit them. And why I say visit them, there was one, in fact, in Parliament, who I came to visit personally. And I can just tell you that there was no intention ever to repay the money that was borrowed. And I would be very sad if this legislation would protect something like that. Secondly, what we're saying is, so I think it must be clear that people who get the benefit of this must be people who will never get out of debt for whatever reason. And it's not because they deliberately went on a spending spree, it's because of circumstances. So I think the criteria, I can't stress that more enough, that is paramount that should be addressed.
Mr. Billum, so tell us. You know, we've heard that the Act as it stands is quite adequate. No problem with it, really, just one or two things. Now you're saying there have been people who have no intention of paying, including a Member of Parliament.
No, sorry, so, if I misheard it, it wasn't a Member of Parliament.
What was it?
It was somebody employed.
Well, somebody employed in Parliament, and you're honestly telling me you had no way of enforcing, of doing something about it. There was nothing you could do. Now, I find that strange. So you need to tell us what we should be doing in the legislation to avoid that.
Yeah, I think it's not only... thank you for that. I think it's not... I can just give you a reassurance to nobody that I see in this room. But I think it's a combination of... Jay, if you look at legislation, and that's why I'm talking about the balance issue, it's becoming more and more difficult for debt credit providers to effectively enforce debt throughout the system, throughout whether it's emolument attachment orders, whatever. It's not becoming easier to enforce debt. And if somebody, I mean, my personal capacity, somebody's been borrowed money from me, where you eloped with the money, and there is really nothing I can do. I can go through, I get summons, but there's no effective mechanism because you're unemployed. I can't even try and get a emolument attachment order. So what I'm saying is the environment in which we operate are getting more and more difficult. So I think, and that's the last point that I'll get to, but let me make it now, is we've got to make sure that this legislation don't give people the wrong message. I really wouldn't like Parliament to give consumers out there the message that, you know, you actually don't need to repay your debt because, you know, we will come to your rescue whenever it's needed. I think that is a very bad message. There need to be responsible borrowing as well as responsible lending, and I think we need to emphasize that. On my shopping list, the second point there is we need participation by credit providers before it gets to the tribunal. we've doubt got, you know, we question whether the period should be as long as 12 months and whether it should be, you know, and whether another period of 12 months after that is appropriate. We've asked you to be look at more objective tests rather than subjective tests, and we've asked that you don't criminalize the industry. On the credit life, we ask that it shouldn't be compulsory. We ask that the caps, if you're going to introduce a new class of credit life, we ask that the caps shouldn't be unrealistic. We ask that there should be no stabilization of assets where credit providers were not reckless. We ask for a more detailed process, including timelines, and measures to ensure that there's enough capacity to make effective decisions. And then, I mean, this is a point that I've made already. It's not the way if we want to build a responsible market, we've got to give the right messages. And we do believe that we could have strengthened the debt counseling mechanism, perhaps through subsidies. I mean, that thought also occurred to us, and we think that maybe that is a more effective way. And you can do it as part of the same process. So you've got already capacity out there in debt counselors. Why not use them to deal with this problem as well in a particular way? But it would require a rethink of legislation. So I hope that although I've got a list of complaints and a list of asks, I hope it's been constructive in some way. Thank you.
Much, Mr. Willems. This now gives us, as members of the committee, the opportunity to engage. Honourable Williams, Honourable Montash, in that order as a start.
Thank you for your presentation. I've just got one question. Why would including a criteria that the individuals must be over-indebted make such a huge difference to, why do you want that to become one of the criteria? Thank you.
I just want to check with the presentative person. Who does he think must subsidize debt counselors? Under which fund? Because my take was, Chairperson, is that when you run your business, No, it is not the government that is responsible for your subsidies in many instances in your private business. So who is going to fund or subsidize our debt counselors?
Honourable Buyani.
Chair, thanks. One clarity-seeking question. I wanted to check because you spoke about capacity. I wanted to check in terms of the qualification whether the NCR directors or members are not qualified and how many years does it take to acquire capacity. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Perhaps you could address those, Mr. Willems.
Thank you, Chair. I think the important thing is that, you know, I've never seen any application in any terms of any act where the criteria that you need to meet in order to be successful in application is not clearly spelled out. I think it's a fundamental flaw in the legislation. And certainly I don't want to assist anybody that's not over-indebted. If he's not over-indebted, then that person should repay my loan. We're not in the donor market. We grant money, we expect people to pay it. If they can't pay it, for good reason, then obviously we have sympathy. So I think that is really the reason. In fact, I would go further and say it must be more than just over indebted. There must be a very good indication that person will never be able to repay the loan. Then on the subsidies, you know, the moment, if we look at the proposal now, the proposal is that all of this is actually funded by credit providers. That can't be. There's no ways that we can sponsor this. There's some, I don't think, and I'll make it crucified for this, I think the industry would be open to look at ways of how it could be subsidized. But I think it is a responsibility of not only government, but of not only credit providers, but certainly government as well. It's a general problem. And it's not something that the credit providers should, on their own, I think, be sitting with. And then on the capacity issue, I think I'm more worried about, you know, there's no, I've got concerns about the directors and the staff at the NCR. I think it's more the people that will be employed to make these referrals to the, you know, them. I want them to at least know what a credit bureau report looks like. I want them to have a thorough knowledge of the NCR. I want to have them some practical experience to see, you know a bit about life as well and have some balanced judgment. That may be, like you pointed out, Chair, that may be asking too much, but I think certainly there needs to be a training program for those people.
Do members believe their questions or clarifications have been responded to? Do you have any further questions or clarifications? I do have a few. I want to come back to the point raised here. The complexity of determining reckless lending is what it's labelled at. And one or two of the points made here is that credit bureaus' info is not real time. And information, their information needs to be interpreted. Lack of detailed rules there. So what are you proposing in this regard? Are you asking the committee to develop something for this piece of legislation in relation to the data that credit bureaus are providing, or what? Because you are the only person who's raised this specific point. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think there's a lot being done at the moment. I think, and I'm talking now, I don't want to talk for the NCR, but I think there's a realization that part of the problem is the lack of reliable credit bureau information. And there are measures, there's been that regulation, what is it, 17, I'm talking on a correction that was recently introduced. There are measures introduced to improve credit bureaus all the time. And I'm not also attacking the credit bureau information. What I just know from practice is that when you look at the credit bureau report, the ways in which you can interpret it. There's some data that if you're intelligent, you've got to ignore. There's some data that you won't find there. And, you know, when, how many judgments must a person have or not have before you don't lend to him? I mean, there's no rule around that. So it's not mere fact that somebody has a judgment, but doesn't mean to say you can't lend to him. If somebody's got a facility, exactly how much of that facility do you need to build into your assessment? So there are a lot of technical problems, and I'm just mentioning a few, where, certainly my own organization, what we're doing is you're building your own assumptions and rules. And that differs from one credit provider to the other. And over time, I think one need to get, and I think Mrs. Slot had a similar proposal to say, you got to get to a point where whether somebody's reckless or not becomes much more clinical and an easy determination. Because otherwise you're going to have debates and you're going to have persons arguing for and against. But it's not a simple calculation matter. There's interpretation issues which comes into play, and there are timing issues. So that's why I think the notion that we can spy on our competitors and report them is a difficult one for us, and also why I think I am certain that if there are going to be cases now referred in mass to the tribunal, there will be quite a lot of them that I could be attacking successfully to say, but this hasn't been a reckless lending situation.
Of that is because earlier on, and I was just looking to check if Dr. Omar from the BASA is here. He's not, because I raised this with him, and it was on the issue of credit bureaus, and he said, no, the data was not all reliable, could rely on that. Now, there's BASA saying it's reliable and you saying it's not. There are these gaps. So, you know, for us now we have to reconcile these two statements. So what is it that specifically Basel was referring to that is reliable about credit bureaus? And then to compare it to what you are saying now, you can see for us now there is a lack of alignment between the two statements. So perhaps we'll have to get Basel to re-clarify what they meant.
I think, if I can help you, to try and clarify it.
Just a minute. There is someone. Are you from Barca?
Indirectly, yes.
No, well, then just wait there. We'll be writing to you.
Yes. Chair, I think there's been a lot of improvement. I don't want to profess that the data is unreliable at all. But there are situations where credit providers don't load their data, and don't load timely or accurately. So, I mean, that is something which a lot of people are working on, and that is certainly there is improvement there. But I think the reality is just that you can't just rely on the data. You must apply your mind to it, and there are things there which you must ignore, or which you need to say, well, I'm not going to apply it just like that. I'm going to apply it differently.
Ask Mr. Willem, so if you give us a list of what you should ignore, etc., so that when we get the response from Barca, we'll be able to compare it more specifically. Right now, it's confusing the two taken together. You mean this, they mean that. Let's find out exactly what is meant. You also then, on information and communication, oh yeah, that was just a clarification of the word, and I think there was an appeal under criminalization of credit providers and directors not to make this retrospective, I think. So, yes, that's something separate that's come in. And on the next page then, continuing with submissions, etc., debt intervention qualification criteria to be amended and to be strictly limited, etc., that's another point, and so on and so forth. And a very clear proposal, debt never to be extinguished, and a maximum intervention of 12 months to reduce the potential for systemic risk. That is a very clear and specific proposal which the committee will have to look into. But that there should be no offences for directors at all. I think currently governance in the private sector is actually reviewing that approach, as you know yourself. So we'll take that into account with the latest positions that are being under consideration in the private sector. The other issue was to do with young people, which you did try to clarify when you referred to young people coming in and so on and so forth. I can't find it right now, but I was asking you about the expertise, and I think then you responded by saying there should be this training, that training, and the next. I think it's an obligation of the industry to do something about the training of their workers, their employees. There's even a levy provided by government which enables you to pay towards their training. So the state is already contributing by the levy, I know that, for specific training. So it is doing that, but perhaps come back in writing and make a proposal to us as to the kind of training you believe that is essential to bring, you know, you've been through this yourself. You know what was missing and what really helped you. Try and share that with us. And that's meant to be a very positive statement from me and needs to be taken in that manner. But thank you very much for coming here and sharing these issues with us, because you did raise issues that others did not raise. So even though you pointed out, you know, coming at the end, a lot of what you wish to say has been said. You did add to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
We're then going to move on to the next one, and that is the National Debt Counselling Association. So there's the debt counsellors, then there's the national debt counsellors, quite a few of you, yes. Everything has been set up. One of the points made by one of the members yesterday, and perhaps we should have raised again today, what is the profile of your workforce, your employee, your staff profile? What is it? Not only gender, but race as well, because we are in the process of transformation, and you know, in the financial sector, some organizations have done a lot. That's a reality. But some have done very, very little. So if you all send email that back to Mr. Hermans or Mr. Medema, it'll give us a better understanding, because our own experience about the debt people suffering from over-indebtedness as well in this bracket have been that the vast majority are black Africans, the vast majority. Therefore, it becomes pertinent that we know the profile of the people engaging with those who owe this money. You see? Thank you. So, in front of us now, we've got, is it Mr. Benai Sega? Mr. Sega?
Chair, yeah, that's correct. Benai Sega.
Benai Sega. Benai, right. The Chief Operating Officer. IDM. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. Today, my name is Benai Sega. I represent the National Debt Counselling Association. I will speak in a minute about our members. If I may answer your very last question first in terms of the staff component from a transformation perspective. I can speak for the companies that I work with, not our entire association. So, our company has a staff component of 300 people. It's 15% white, 4% Indian, 35% colored, and 46% black. In other words, it's 85% black, as we would normally describe it per South African law. Chair, we thank you very much for the opportunity to share what I hope to be constructive feedback from our association on the debt relief bill. I'd like to start by saying we support the bill, and our members are very excited about the bill, which should come as a relief, because I understand sometimes it's not the case. I will explain I will focus on three primary areas where we believe the quick operationalization of the bill can be enhanced, and we're happy to help. So I will go through three main themes, and at the end I will summarize what those are. So as a start, I would like to explain who we are. We have five member companies. Consumer Debt Help, which is, as far as we know, the only debt counseling company that's focused on helping low-income consumers, and from which I will share some data along the lines that you have asked. Debt Busters, National Debt Advisors, National Debt Counselors, and Pioneer Debt Solutions. Our companies serve approximately 60,000 active consumers, which we believe makes up about 30% of the debt counseling consumer market. Over the last decade, our member companies have helped over 100,000 consumers, which, if you assume they each have families of four, we probably reached about 400,000 South Africans to help them. We have 200 registered debt counselors, with another 100 pending with the regulator. And our total staff component is 800. As I said, Chair, our comments should be taken as constructive. We believe it's crucial to have a significant role for the NCR and for the NCT for the success of the bill. So our comments should be seen in light of trying to help operationalize that as quickly as possible. As I said, our members are very excited about being able to help 5 million people over the next few years. So as I said, I will focus on three primary areas in terms of what we see as small changes to what's being proposed to help operationalize the bill. So the first one I'd like to focus on is how we can potentially utilize the existing infrastructure of debt counselors. Chair and members, debt counseling has been around for about 10 years. It was a creation of the National Credit Act. Many of you have had a hand in it. And since that time, with NCR and NCT's help, what we believe a fantastic infrastructure of over 3,000 debt counselors have been set up in the country. Not all of these debt counselors are active, which I will explain a little bit later in the presentation why that is the case. However, we believe in terms of employment, about 8,000 to 10,000 highly skilled individuals are employed in this industry, both in debt counselors, attorney firms, credit providers, and so on. And collectively, the debt counselors speak to probably about 1 million consumers each year who make requests, finding out about the potential solutions and all of that. And I would like to highlight that as part of these assessments, debt counselors review income and expenses, often buy and share free of charge with the consumer their credit report. And unfortunately, we know that only 3% of South Africans have ever seen credit reports, so it comes as a big surprise to many of these consumers. But it's a fantastic way to make them aware of their cost of credit. As part of the same assessment, you determine debt and make over-indebtedness assessment. And if someone is deemed to be over-indebted and they join debt counseling, their debt repayments are renegotiated to a more affordable level. Honorable Chair and members, I'd like to submit that all of these activities are very much in overlap with what one would need to do as part of the debt relief bill in terms of determining someone's financial situation. So we believe the industry has the infrastructure and the reach to deal with assessments from the debt relief bill. And in any case, our members, along with other debt counselors, already speak to many of these individuals who would be primary target of the debt relief bill. In terms of operationalizing such a bill, I don't need to repeat many of what colleagues said. We're talking about potentially a larger number of consumers who would get relief. And in terms of collating their incomes, credit reports, other documents, ID books, and establishing who they are, their financial situation, as one can appreciate, it's quite a bit of work. And with debt counselors already having to do many of these activities, we believe it would be fantastic if debt counselors could be made part of the assessment process to help the NCR and the tribunal in terms of speeding up how we can potentially help. And I will explain how they could work. So therefore, we believe and submit that DC should also be allowed to make the assessment on behalf of the consumers. I would like to now spend a few minutes talking about the low-income or no-income consumer. I think many of us have an idea what this looks like, but if I can paint the picture for you and give you real examples of what these consumers are facing, I think it would be most powerful. As I said, Consumer Debt Hub is one of our member companies that focuses on exclusively low-income consumers. They've been doing this since 2013, and over that period they've helped 10,000 people. I want to share some statistics with the committee on what a low-income consumer looks like, what the profile is. Average age is just over 30. Income from what we find is just over 7,000 Rand, which means net what they take home is just over 5,600 Rand. And the debt when they come to us, what we find is their outstanding debt is just under 40,000 Rand. And this tends to be almost always exclusively unsecured debt. Normally, they're able to repay their debt with renegotiated agreements in just under 4 years. And what they have to pay before they come to us is, if you look at the net amount that they take, net income is just over 5,600 Rand. If they had to pay all of their debts on time every month before they come to us, they would need to spend just over under 5,500 Rand of this towards debt repayment. So in essence, what you're facing is 150 Rand left for these consumers to get by, and we can all agree that's not really feasible. So what the member company does is it renegotiates the debt on their behalf, and generally what they end up paying over thanks to concessions from, you know, credit providers and all of that, over an extended period of roughly about 42 months, they instead of paying $5,500 per month, they pay $1,100 roughly per month. That provides them much needed cash flow. So in essence, what we find is these consumers need about 80% of their net income for basic necessities every month. So therefore, you know, with renegotiating their creditors and, you know, restructuring the debt, we're also able to reduce the average interest rate from about 23% to just under 5% in terms of debt repayment, and brings much needed relief. Chair, I wanted to spend a few more minutes explaining with some detail within this company. We looked at even more detail in terms of the different income groups. And in particular, I'd like to focus on three groups. One is individuals earning less than 3,500 rand per month. The second group is between 3,500 to 5,000 rand. And the third group is earning between over 5,000 rand. And for each one, I try to give as many stats as possible here. So starting from the top left of the page, the median income when they come to us, you can see it's for those earning less than 3,500, it's about 3,000. 3 to 5 range is 4.2, and more than 5,000 is 8,000. The reason for that is some of these people would earn more than 7,500, closer to 10. When you look at what they should be paying in terms of debt repayments on a monthly basis, it ranges from 2,200 to upwards of 4,500. And in terms of the debt that they have, in terms of the overall debt that they have, you can see it ranges from 25,000 to 41,000. And in terms of the credit agreements they have, it's either 4 or 5 in our experience. And this would be a combination of a store card, it would be an unsecured loan, and most likely what they call a payday loan, you know, less than 30 days, and a few other things. There would not be any secured assets in here, and most of these individuals, almost all of them, would not have it. And in terms of who, what does this individual look like? You know, we talked about the race and the demographics in terms of the split I gave it. I would say it's relatively consistent across the different income groups. 60% black, 20% colored, 15% white, more or less, and about 2-3% Asian/Indian. And if you look at when we restructure their debts by, you know, in negotiating with credit providers and what they end up paying while they're under debt review, some of our consumers pay as little as 699 rand per month, which is a massive relief, as you can imagine. And some of them pay, you know, over 1,000 rand. But in general, we're able to reduce the monthly debt repayments between 68 to 75%. So that's what a typical low-income individual looks like when they come to debt counseling. Speaking of debt counseling, as I said before, it's a world-class creation, and the NCR and the NCT and the DTI and many other departments and this committee have worked very hard to make it work. We believe it works, and I will qualify that in terms of how it works in a later stage. It's also an important job creation, you know, in terms of the industries are concerned. Many of our employees, in terms of the association, are well qualified. Majority of them have tertiary degrees, and you know, they do get significant training. They go on the DC course, which is quite intensive. So we believe that counseling is also an important job creation factor. I alluded earlier as to why not all of the 3,000 odd debt counselors are practicing. And I think this has been a combination of, let's just call it the perfect storm. The economy has been falling on tough times, and as one would expect, that impacts a lot of the long-term decisions people would make. At the same time, over the last several years, inflation has gone up, but in terms of our primary income, which are the regulated DC fees, that has not changed. Not to belligerate the point, I think my colleague Paul Slott also made the same assertion yesterday, but predominantly the reason why many of the debt counselors could not make it work is this. Also, our member companies, I believe you asked the question, what's different about us and the Paul Slots Association? Our member companies are large in terms of employment. The smallest one employs 100 people, the largest one 300 people. And because we operate from a centralized location, we're able to provide economies of scale in terms of being able to serve many thousands of consumers. Those who have not been able to do this or chose not to do this have had quite difficult time over the last several years in terms of surviving in the industry when regulated income has not increased. In terms of contribution to repayments and the economy, I also would like to point out, I think many of these points were made. Typical month, all consumers under debt counseling, which are reckoned to be between 190 to 220,000 individuals who are paying regularly, pay between 800 to 900 million rand towards their debt on a monthly basis. So when you look at it over the course of a year, we're talking about 10 billion rand. In terms of the number of credit agreements that are touched by this, we estimate it's about 2 million. And in terms of the number of activities that are required per consumer to get them on board with debt counseling, it's about 200 individual steps. And part of the reason why I think many of the comments were made that counseling does not work for low-income consumers, I would like to explain why that is, if I may. as we said before, economically speaking, anyone who is the way that debt counselors earn their income is when debt is restructured and renegotiated over the course of, let's say, 3 to 5 years, depending on the level of debt, it's broken down into monthly payments. So the consumer is told, let's say, over the next 36 months or 48 months, they're going to pay 2,000 rand or 3,000 rand or 4,000 rand, whatever the amount is. The debt counselor takes the first month's fee up to 6,000 rand. And I think there's sometimes a misconception that you take a fee of 6,000 rand. It's up to 6,000 rand. The average is somewhere between 3,000 and 3,500. From second month onwards, third month onwards, in terms of the payment that is made, debt counselors take either 5% or 3% of the monthly repayment. So if we now think about our particular low-income consumer company, Debt Consumer Debt Help, average consumer there is paying 1,000 rand. 5% of that is 50 rand. It's very little amount of money in terms of being able to pay for the cost that comes with these 200-odd activities to stay in business. So if one doesn't get to scale, it doesn't work. Therefore, what happens is many of the consumers, even though they would qualify for debt review and they would be able to pay for it, are essentially not necessarily encouraged by debt counselors because the money a debt counselor would make from that individual is too low. And I will speak later on about a potential subsidy that was already in place several years ago. One of the other reasons why we think that counselors could be involved in terms of debt assessment is, I think yesterday a few points were made about the operational capacity and systems capacity that would be required from the regulator and from the tribunal. It is true that the systems requirement is hefty, but I'd like to submit to the committee that there's already a centralized debt help system that NCR runs, and it's been in existence for about 5 or 6 years that works extremely well. And I would like to explain, I tried to take some screenshots to explain how it works. And we believe something similar to this or an enhancement of this could be made available for the debt relief bill participants to allow for almost a central repository of recording individuals. So each debt counselor, when you register with the NCR, you get a login to this website, and the primary purpose is to allow debt counselors to register individuals who they sign up to debt counseling. You have your own login, as I show at the top left corner. Then you come to a menu where you're presented with a number of options, and I apologize, the writing is a little bit small, Chair, but the ones in purple where it says register or update consumer, when you click on that, the screen on the right opens up where you ask to submit information about a consumer. So this is basic demographic information like the ID number, name, address, and so on. And when you finish with this, you're basically signing someone up to debt counseling. You click the submit button, and information is automatically stored with the regulator, that health system. And every night, these records, either uploaded or made different, are submitted to the credit bureaus, all of the major credit bureaus. So they actually have a repository on a daily basis to see who are the people whose debt review status has been updated, or someone new, or when someone also finishes debt review, we follow the same process to remove them. So that's how the information is relayed to the credit bureaus. So we would like to submit that a variation of this or an enhancement of the system could be made available. You know, obviously nothing comes for free, but for, I would hope, for less development cost than one would hope in terms of massive systems requirements. I would like to move on to the second part of my presentation, where I talk about using existing provisions of the National Credit Act and existing avenues in terms of helping some of these consumers, again, in terms of supplementing what's being proposed in the bill. We believe that many over-indebted consumers and many consumers who actually have credit agreements already have credit insurance or credit life insurance as part of the credit agreements they signed in the past. However, the problem is we also believe many of them are not aware of this, either because they don't have a paper trail of what they signed, it's been many years, or they were not properly informed, whatever the reason might be. We actually have done some analysis, which I will show on the next page, that about 20% of credit agreements in South Africa have credit life. So what we would actually submit to the committee is, as part of the debt relief assessment, whether an existing credit life insurance exists on a particular credit agreement, and if this could potentially cover outstanding debt if there's retrenchment or some other disability in place for these affected consumers, we believe this should be evaluated on a personal basis, because this is an existing avenue that's not necessarily explored, and these consumers have paid for this, and they should be using this avenue. Secondly, the DTI and NCR have done quite a bit of work in terms of reckless lending, and I fully agree with everyone that this is a challenge in terms of identifying, in terms of preventing, and so on. However, I also believe that there's some tools available already in the Act to help us and the regulations. For example, currently 9% of a consumer's net income could be used by a credit provider in terms of saying this is a minimum necessary expense. This could be increased to 20% or 25%, or in some of the cases, for example, in the country of Mauritius, the same threshold is 40%. So if anyone tries to borrow more than 40% of their net income from any credit provider, they are not allowed further credit. So what we're suggesting is the avenue is already available to the minister and to the committee in terms of changing these tables to make the number a little bit higher if needed. We also believe that in terms of punishment for reckless lending, what's provided in the Act is adequate. And the difficulty in assessing reckless lending has been established, I think, and I will elaborate a little bit about what we do here. But in terms of what debt counselors already do, there's already an assessment that many debt counselors do and get excellent results, I would submit to the committee, in getting some debt written off in negotiating with credit providers. And these statistics are meant to be submitted to the regulator on a quarterly basis as part of our submissions. So in summary, what we'd say is in terms of asking consumers to buy what might be expensive credit life insurance and introducing provisions, we'd like the committee to consider how we best use existing Act's provisions. Honourable Chair and members, credit life is a big topic. It's an important topic. And I know that there are regulations that were put in place in August 2017. But I wanted to paint the picture when we analyze in terms of credit life agreements on the credit agreements before August 9, 2017. We looked at a number of credit providers, and we looked at how much they are charging for credit life, and we also looked at what percent of their credit agreements have credit life. Again, as in support of the argument we were making that for for many of these consumers, they're already paying for credit life in existing agreements. So it might be an avenue to explore in case there's retrenchments or dread disease or disability and so on. So this is information pre-August 2017, but I think the percentages should probably be similar. And you find wide variation, from all the way from retailers to banks. But on average, we find that about 20% of all credit agreements in South Africa have some form of credit insurance attached to it. I also wanted to demonstrate for a typical consumer what is the cost of credit and what is the actual burden they walk away with by submitting two specific examples to the committee. One is a loan of 160,000 Rand, and this was not granted to a low-income consumer, but I wanted to demonstrate the point. And the second one is a 46,800 Rand loan. So I will start with the one at the top, and I try to highlight the important things with the yellow colors. The original loan amount is 160,000 Rand. The monthly amount that the consumer would pay at the top right is 5,200 Rand. Over 60 months. So in total, the consumer ends up paying about 312,000 Rand when everything is said and done. So roughly about twice of what they borrowed. If you look at the credit life insurance component of it, it's just under 9%. So credit life obviously adds to the cost of borrowing. So we wanted to highlight that I think one needs to be quite careful in terms of for we're talking about poorest of the poor in terms of pushing the cost of credit for these individuals. One needs to be cognizant that at the current rates, it may push them towards levels that are not sustainable for their borrowing. The second example is one where just under 47,000 Rand was borrowed. Here, the total amount that will be repaid is 104,600 Rand. About 224% of the original, and the monthly repayment is about 1,740 odd rand. Again, a 60-month loan. So I want to make sure that we understand what the consumer deals with. So roughly between 7 to 10% of their monthly debt repayment would go towards credit life. I spoke a little bit earlier about the regulations in terms of the National Credit Act amendments from 2015. One of the things that was put in there was to bring some sort of more regulation towards the affordability assessments. There's now strict guidelines in terms of needing to provide 3 months bank statements or 3 months payslips and so on. But in terms of the expenses and what's allowable, there are two scenarios. One is that the consumer is able to demonstrate specific payment amounts for each of the individual items. In the case they're not able to demonstrate, they can essentially agree to what percent of their net income they deem to be paid towards necessary expenses. And the highest percent that you see is in the middle bracket there, people earning between 6,250 and 25,000 Rand, where we're saying We those people's necessary expenses are between 1,160 Rand or something like that. So here's where we submit to the committee that the DTR and the NCR and the committee have the power to change this to make it a higher number, to make additional borrowing more difficult for the consumers. I wanted to talk a little bit about reckless lending. As everyone said, establishing reckless lending is art as well as a science. What we normally do is we look at the individual's borrowing history. So we get the entire credit report from the beginning of time, and we look at their income at that particular point in time, and we quantify the monthly repayment of each successive loan, from loan number one to loan number whatever it might be. And we look for the one where one loan where it breached what we would deem to be the necessary expenses. And Honorable Chair and members, in our experience, our companies, what we find is individuals need at least two-thirds of their net income two-thirds of their net income to pay for necessary expenses and their kids and clothing and everything that they deem to be. So if you use round numbers, if someone is earning 5,000 Rand, we believe they would need at least 3,500 Rand of that to pay for the expenses. Therefore, the amount they should be spending towards debt repayments should not be more than 40% of the net income. So what we normally do is we look at each impact of each successive loan that individual was granted in terms of their ability to pay back. And where it breaches that two-thirds amount, we basically request a document from that particular credit provider in terms of what was the information they used at the time they granted the loan to grant this loan. And we try to compare that to the information that was submitted to us by the consumer when they come to us. And I wanted to give a couple of examples. I think the numbers speak for themselves. And how this works is essentially we would negotiate with the credit provider to understand what were the circumstances. And often cases that not, where this happens, they would agree to sort of writing off the loan. So what we would suggest is a similar process is followed across the industry. And, you know, essentially instead of going to litigation for reckless lending, this is done on a debt write-off type of thing. I also wanted to display in terms of the scale of what we're talking about. These are stats from 1 year from one of our companies in terms of how many credit agreements were investigated. Thank you, Chair. What I try to demonstrate here is the scale of the number of accounts that we investigated. So we're talking about 700 or 800 accounts that we investigated, and using the logic that I used before, and we were able to secure 2 million rands worth of debt write-offs on behalf of these consumers during one particular year. And at the bottom half of the page, what I try to demonstrate is that in terms of our quarterly filing as debt counselors to the NCR, we have to submit reckless credit findings and so on. So this information could again be aggregated and used in terms of publishing stats, but also using it effectively to make whatever changes may be necessary from reckless lending. With that, I'd like to move to page 17, which brings me to the last part of my presentation, which is how best to target the population who would benefit the most. I think many of the speakers spoke to the same point. Many of the targeted consumers can afford other avenues. Therefore, we believe some criteria such as debt income ratio or over indebtedness, as was mentioned, could be put in place to ensure those who can afford to pay down their debt within existing debt relief avenues that are available to them. And those consumers who can afford debt counseling should be given given a reintroduction of a low income subsidy. Chair, I'd like to point out that low income subsidy for debt counseling is not a new concept. In fact, it was in existence for a few years in the late 2000s, early 2010s. My company, IDM, has been involved since 2012 in working with the regulator and the tribunal in trying to reintroduce the low-income subsidy. So many of the speakers have spoken about this. It's not a new concept. It's something that was in place. And as we alluded to earlier, it could help some of the individuals find other avenues. In terms of debt counseling, I also wanted to express on page 19 what portion of the amount that the consumer pays over the course of debt counseling actually goes back to paying back to the original lenders, credit providers. And we find this to be about 94%, meaning only 6% would be the cost that's paid to, you know, debt counselors, PDAs, and so on, which we believe to be quite an effective mechanism in terms of recovering the amount for credit providers. But we also know low-income consumers struggle with in terms of debt levels. Page 20, what I tried to highlight was when you look at the different income groups, and I focus specifically on those earning less than 8,000 Rand. In this case, we can use it as a proxy for those earning less than 7,500. In terms of the total debt that these consumers have, when you divide it by their income, it's not that much as a percentage. You know, often the numbers are given as to, you know, in other countries, the debt-to-income ratio is 150%, 140%. Australia has 145%. In South Africa, the comparable figure is much lower. However, the nature of our debt, and particularly with the poorest of our poor, is high interest rate, unsecured loans. Therefore, the monthly debt burden on these individuals is substantially higher. So what I try to highlight on this page is that if you look at the bottom half, this means many of these consumers would need up to 98% of their net income to repay their debt on a monthly basis as a result of high interest rates. And I believe everyone in this room would agree with me that's not sustainable and it's theoretically not possible. So in terms of low-income subsidy, as I said, we had submitted a proposal a long time ago. I would like to just give the highlights. And this is to cover, in terms of the cost of what it takes to serve these consumers, to make them more attractive to debt counselors so that more of them would be taken on. And we envision a model where certain requirements must be met. Of course, the debt counselor must be registered with the regulator, and they need to be using a registered payment distribution agent, and they need to use debt counseling rule set, which is essentially a non-manual intervention that speeds up the renegotiation process and makes it far more affordable for consumers rather than in-person negotiation. And we would submit to the committee that an appropriate amount is set in terms of the fee. We propose an amount here. I don't need to necessarily go into the detail. But, you know, in terms of the mechanics, we were very happy to work with the committee at a later stage to establish how this might work. Honourable Chair and members, I'd like to summarise what I have discussed. firstly, I would like to say thank you again for giving us the opportunity. NDCA supports the bill, and we're here to help give constructive feedback. But also, we're happy to share the data with the committee to refine the bill. Our members are excited about helping these consumers, and we state that the NCR and the NCT are essential parts of making this debt relief bill work. We would like to invite the committee to come see how debt counseling works, because a few of our member committees are institutions are based in Cape Town, short walk away. To really demonstrate to you what we do for the consumers and what we can do to help even more over-indebted consumers with regards to the debt relief bill. We, in terms of the ability to operationalize the bill in a short amount of time, because, you know, time is not on our side, and to assist the NCR and the NCT, we suggest three adjustments. One is utilizing the existing infrastructure of debt counselors. As we said, many of the debt counselors already speak to many of these consumers. The infrastructure already exists. Many consumers find debt counselors through the internet or some other means, so they're readily available. And to use the NCT for certifying the assessments completed by debt counselors, similar to how the debt counseling process works now in terms of taking the NCT, and to use the NCR's help in terms of establishing the repository, but also regulating and guiding in how this could be operationalized at high level. We also submit to the committee that to pay for the cost, there should be a flat fee, but an affordable flat fee introduced. Our second overall theme and submission is to use the existing NCA provisions and avenues. As I said, using existing credit life insurance, which debt counselors can find out when we get the the actual credit agreement and assess whether this could be an avenue for the individual based on how they became, if they lost the job and so on. Changing the minimum necessary expenses in table and regulations from 9% to a much higher number, 20-25% even higher, to alleviate future reckless lending and limit a person's ability to borrow beyond a particular level of their net income, to using the data submitted by debt counselors to establish cases of reckless lending and refrain from introducing negligence clauses that could drive more debt counselors out of industry, and to as much as possible to not force consumers to buy expensive credit life insurance, but you know, being cognizant that the right balance needs to be struck in terms of cost of credit. And our third submission is to target the population that would benefit the most. Similar to other individuals who are here, the debt income ratio is a good indicator to understand who some of the individuals might qualify for other avenues, and to truly establish those who can afford to pay down their debt within existing avenues. And you know, those consumers who can afford debt counseling to be considered for a low income subsidy. Chair, I'd like to conclude my presentation there, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sager. Yes. So, members, over to you now, and I'm glad the members who had to attend the Portfolio Committee on Labour, our members have sit on more than one, thank you for coming back, returning to this public hearing, both of you. All right. Honourable Gesterhazen, who else? Yes, Honourable Van Skalkwyk. Those two at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My apology for being a bit late. I need debt counselling for SARS. I didn't get a whole presentation as I was with income tax people. Debt counseling, in my opinion, should be there to simplifying your, not only to be simplifying your finances, but it must be about your money cash flow as well, to explain to people about their money cash flow. And for debt counseling to work, a person must understand what he owes, not only to the creditors, but the interest also, which is very important. What are you repaying? And would you should be eligible for a debt consolidation loan? And that also, for me, the sole purpose, I think, of this bill should be to look after the poor, you know, and the people who couldn't understand. And consolidation loans are unsecured loans and attract a maximum of 28% interest, which is, a lot of people cannot afford that. So debt consolidation is going to cost you more in the long run. And my humble opinion, it's debt counseling. So for, you know, there's a lot of people that haven't got the home loans, and but I think a home loan would be the cheapest for debt counseling to advise people to use your the cheapest would be to use your home loan, which debt counseling is repo plus 21% consolidation. You know, your home loans could cost you, for some people, interest or prime plus one. Well, in for more, they're different on individual cases. But I think that's what the counseling should be about, to advise them.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like the small part that I received of the presentation like to welcome that. I've seen that you are supporting and you are excited about this intervention that we want to make. But you are making a few proposals like the utilization of existing infrastructure and advice and what. So I just need to know, would that be free of charge, or at which rate are you going to charge it to the government in terms of ensuring that we reach the ultimate goal? And then you are speaking of the credit providers that you're already dealing with in terms of reckless lending practices, and you are also renegotiating terms and conditions. Do you have perhaps data available for us to establish at which level can did you identify in terms of numbers? How many reckless lending practices have you identified versus your total number of clients that you are serving? Thank you, Chairperson.
Is there anyone else?
Thank you, Chair, and all the members. I'll start with answering the first question from Honourable Esther Hayden. Debt consolidation is, as you said, it's essentially putting all your debts in one and giving you a jumbo loan. And what generally happens is when a person receives a debt consolidation loan, it looks great, but after a few months or years, they go into further debt. It's not a sustainable solution. In terms of using home loans to pay down debt, I think unfortunately when many people come to us, it's almost too late for that situation. They have been in arrears for a long time, or they're really struggling. And the typical pattern that we would see is that they would, in some cases, if they have a home loan, they'll have a vehicle finance as well. And then they will borrow a personal loan from a bank. When that is no longer an opportunity for them, then they will go to other lenders to borrow another personal loan. And at the very end, they will go, if needed, to what is known as payday loans. So these are things that need to be paid at very high interest rates. So unfortunately, the pattern that we see is this. I fully agree with your assertion that it is our jobs to give advice to people, and we do. Whether they sign up with us or not, we give them their free credit report, and there's always a consultation that's given, and our hope is that we will be able to reach more people in terms of giving this advice. To Honourable Van Schalkwyk's two questions, I think your first question was, would it be free of charge, or what rate would be charged? So I think in the beginning of the presentation, also on the last page, I think this is really helping low-income consumers or no-income consumers. If debt counselors are allowed to use and be able to get to the assessments, I believe that because of the infrastructure that's there, we would be able to keep the cost to a minimum in being able to serve many people in a rapid way. So what I envision is that assessment is made by a debt counselor, then a file is compiled, so information is requested from the consumer in terms of income or no income, ID documents, bank statements. Then information is requested from credit bureau or credit providers. Those are all compiled to establish what is the status of that individual. Then if we will indeed do the credit insurance assessment, which is what we're proposing, to see whether there is credit insurance that might be able to pay, that will also take some time and effort. So I don't have a particular number in mind, but I think it should be fair compensation in terms of the work that this would involve in terms of covering the costs, with keeping in mind that you know, the ultimate goal is, I think, for everyone to try to get these people reintroduced back into the credit industry as one of the engines of growth in the country. Your second question on the data available on reckless lending practices, I think if I refer back to slide number 16, this is 1 year's snapshot for the year 2016 to show how many cases were suspected in terms of reckless lending and how many were analyzed. So if you add up all of this, it's just under 800, I believe. And we normally, in this particular instance, we're probably talking about you know, somewhere between 150 to 200,000 credit agreements that we would have looked at. So the numbers are actually quite small. It's less than 1%. However, when it does happen, it obviously has massive impact on the individual. So to answer your question, we do have data available from our members going back a few years in terms of what percent of the cases could have been reckless lending. We have the data. It's available. Madam Chair, I didn't catch any more questions, so...
You know, we don't want you to have to change your bait while you're fishing, but are there any other comments or questions? I do have a couple myself. I think someone in the committee has commented on this, and so have you yourself. But I think it needs to be highlighted, the practice of increasing quite significantly the interest rate on a lower loan. It's almost as if we're going to make this amount of profit. Or what is it that governs or informs this practice? Is it because you're saying whether you take a 10,000 Rand loan, we're going to have to spend X amount on administration to when you take a 300,000. What informs that practice of a higher interest, a significantly higher interest on a lower loan amount over the same term? One. The other thing, of course, it applies to ledger fees and the like, that the more money you have, the lower your ledger fees, as it were. So there are issues that could be immediately addressed. You have emphasized the point of how much you require an individual for basic needs, and that cannot be emphasized too strongly. You made a reference and asked if it couldn't be considered again about at one point a low-income subsidy was made available, and it has stopped. Were you told why it has been stopped, or you know, got any idea why it's stopped, etc.? The last point is this, that while on the one hand people on their monthly income are assessed in a particular way and analysed, and presumably no one yet knows when you're going to pop off, why is it that the day you turn 70, a different form of analysis is undertaken? You are immediately at the highest risk level and cannot obtain a loan. Now, I have been fortunate, I'm 74, that I've learned certain ropes. But many, many people at 70, and I believe it's even lower, are told, quite frankly, that is the policy. So you have a sound profile, but you cannot access a loan, even though such a person may be working. What is it? And if you are aware, perhaps you can share it with us. But I must say, I found some of the points you made here, many of them, very constructive. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, for the comments and questions. I believe the first one was... your question about essentially what determines the interest rate that one gets. Is it the size of the loan? I think it's the nature of the loan. If whenever there's an asset attached to a loan, then the lending institution can come after if need be and take that asset away if there's a default. And I think it's a combination of the nature of the loan but also the income level that the individual has. And if you are requesting a loan that is deemed to be higher than a particular percentage of your income, I think they're happy to give you the money potentially, but at a higher interest rate, meaning there's a higher probability that you will default. That would be my explanation. I'm not a banker, so please qualify that. I'm a debt counselor. In terms of the question about the low income subsidy, why it was stopped, this is before I joined this industry, so I do not know. But, you know, maybe the NCR could comment on the reasons and the history beyond that. You comment about the using the net income of the individuals to really assess how much they need. This has been our experience time and again, that anyone who is required to pay more than 40% of their net income really struggles, and at some point, sooner or later, they default on one or more payments. So we really would say, like, in for a sustainability perspective, it's a very important threshold. And your last question about why does the approach to someone over 70 is different from a risk perspective, again, I'm not a banker, I'm not in the job of lending, but I can only speculate that 70 was seen for a long time as kind of the life limit of individuals. So anytime you go over that, even though our life expectancy has shot through way beyond that, to the extent that some of us will probably not be able to afford to retire, I do not believe that would be my only explanation as why debt limit is used. Other than that, I don't really know.
Number of people who are pensioners in theory but working have pointed this out, and when you go to the banks, they confirm that the risk profile of such people is more reliable than others. So it contradicts the result or the consequence of it. So I would suggest that they do look at this by, young drivers, as it were. If you're under 22 or something, it's your insurance costs you more than 25. And then you have women's insurance because women are seen as safer drivers, lower, etc. So these things are known. These are actuarial assessments. But as I say, there would appear to be something that we're not informed about that is guiding the decision-making in the banks as well as elsewhere. It's not only the banks that make funding available or loans. Right. But thank you very much indeed for that. And we will then take our final presenter, Ms. Yvonne Oberholzer. I've seen this name before, I think, in the financial transformation hearings. Am I right? Yes. So you're very familiar about how we run things, and you're accompanied by a Mr. Dion. Is it Oberholzer or Oberholzer? With a T-E-R. As an interested party, not a relative. Well, there we are. Husband is always a spouse interested in what the other one is up to. But just before you give us the presentation, I mentioned the National Credit Regulator and DTI. We also have the National Consumer Tribunal, who's listening with interest and following all of the presentations yesterday and earlier and again today. But over to you then, Ms. Oberholzer.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, for the opportunity. Madam Chair, okay, well, I'm sure you're about to be elevated. My point number one, it's been discussed at great length today, so I won't labour it too much. I think the law itself is outstanding because these people have been neglected, if I may say so. We come from a farming background. We have two farms where the staff are extremely marginalised. I mean, when we bought the one farm, they'd never had leave in their life. Some of them had no IDs. We took them to Worcester, which was the closest place to get their IDs. You don't realize how impoverished they actually are. They've got no clue about banking, what their rights are. We opened bank accounts for them, instituted a training program to help them with just basic debits and credits. These people then, they want to take it a notch up, so they go to maybe borrow money. They don't have a clue what they're even signing for. And, there are people that take advantage and lend the money they can't afford. And I feel this bill is going to address that, because if you lend money when you know you shouldn't be, then you don't deserve to get it back. That's my feeling. Then these people should have it written off, because they really are ignorance and they're marginalized. Yes, they are the workers. Yes, they are the workers. Our staff all were paid above the minimum wage, but nevertheless, the laborers are not paid a lot of money, unfortunately. So that's what I'll say to point number one. So yes, I understand I'm not a credit provider, so I'm looking at it from other eyes, but I've seen how these people, the workers, I've seen how they really battle and struggle. They've also got school fees that they've got to pay, etc. So, yeah. My concerns regarding the implementation of the bill. Here's a spare one. Yes, certainly. My concerns regarding the implementation of the bill, unless the bill is well written and made sure that it's totally plugged so that there's no abuse being able to be sort of perpetuated by certain individuals, it's going to be quite difficult. Also, the problems of the organs of the state and the NCR, they're very overburdened. I have first-hand experience with this. I have been busy with them, as you know, since last year. I went up to see them, and they told me they are so stretched for resources. They just don't have enough people to go around. So you can't blame them for the time they are taking, but people get frustrated. I mean, the guy that I spoke to there, and the staff are courteous, they're helpful. He told me himself that they had a complainant who got so frustrated that he went into an APSA branch, I'm assuming it's up in the coating area, and he started taking off his clothes. He took a journalist along to an APSA branch. The gentleman at NC. No. A banking hall, an APSA banking hall, with a journalist and a photographer. And he started taking off his clothes because he was so frustrated. And an APSA official hurried out, took him into an office, the camera was confiscated, and he said this is what people are resorting to do because they are so frustrated with the time. Now, unless they're going to be employing a lot more people, you're going to have a huge bottleneck with this new bill because they're going to be going referred and referred and referred, and that they can't cope with what they've currently got. So that's what I see as a problem. I took it upon myself to provide them with a lot of case law research to try and ease their burden, but they're still struggling to address my issue. Well, I first had one lady, and then I had a gentleman, and then I went on to another lady.
You've lost me a little. Which institution?
The NCR.
Oh, the National
NCR,
Credit
the National
Regulator.
Credit.
No,
yeah.
thank you.
Sorry.
I wasn't sure if we were still at APSA where the undressing occurred.
No. We've passed that. Because he suggested I might like to do that if I got sort of a bit impatient. Okay, so I suggest that the NCR, if they're going to be approached to do this, they need additional resources and plenty because they're not coping. You can see it. They're just human resources. They need human resources. They just don't have, and as it was explained to me, then this one is sick and that one is on leave, and so they just never have a full complement of staff, as it was explained to me. So they definitely will not cope with additional workload. I also see that the target market for this new law, those people are very lacking in education and skills. So somehow they should, maybe workshops, I don't quite know how it could be implemented, but just workshops where there could be basic education programs for this target market so that they just a little bit more au fait with what's going down in the marketplace. If they should want to go and take out a personal loan or borrow money, the implications, a lot of them, they just are totally unaware. So I see it as a learning and educational thing for that group of people. They also need to be made aware of their rights. And here I must discuss this ongoing case where people of colour were charged higher interest rates. Now, I haven't been personally involved with this, but I know the person who is doing it. And he's just from pillar to post, and the case gets postponed, and it should have been in February, now it's in August, to reclaim this money where they've been overcharged. It is First National Bank. So if they knew their rights and what and how to even look at a bank statement, they would have known, but they don't. So they get taken advantage of. So for me, that is a big issue. And the fact that the case just gets postponed all the time is an even bigger issue for me, because they're not getting, it's not getting the attention that it actually deserves. The problems that occur when well-meaning legislation is abused and the repercussions thereof, my main complaint, my partner will now elaborate further, was I was sequestrated for going under debt review, which is, to me, totally unlawful. I actually went to see the credit regulator about this because they told me that it is legislated and it's case law. I have got three case laws where the judge unequivocally says it is not an act of insolvency. So there is a court rule number, well, actually Superior Courts Act number 10 of 2013, where it says if there's differing judgments in a different division, it's got to go for a review. Because if I was living in the Eastern Cape, I wouldn't be on the street. But because I'm in the Western Cape, they ruled that it is an act of insolvency. So they took everything. They took my home, my furniture, everything. Yeah, that to me is just not justice, and I'm trying to get justice for myself. I'm trying to enforce my constitutional rights, because apart from all of this, there were serious other incidents that happened to me. I had my home invaded, I was arrested just because I went under debt review. Well, it's not acceptable, and that's why I will persist. I've been fighting this for 5 years now, and that is not justice, and that is not what our constitution is about. So why I'm mentioning this is because if a bill is not drafted properly, you get the unscrupulous people that make misuse of it, and you see what happens when this happens. And I pointed out to the National Credit Regulator all the rules that have broken as well, how the National Credit Act has been totally, totally ignored. And still, I'm not getting any satisfaction from them. So I don't know if it's because they don't have enough staff or what it is. But all I know is that I'm not getting anywhere with these people. They've now sent me a letter saying that I must just go back to APSA. I got a letter yesterday. I must go back to APSA because they can't do anything about it. But they ignore the debt review issue. So, now I will hand you over to my partner, who will further go on to further the repercussions.
For the fear of God, all right. But let us allow Mr. Oberholster to...
I know the fear of God and the fear of my wife. I just want to elaborate a bit on our project that we have on our series farm. We set up a workers' trust. They were going to own 51% of the shares in the farm. The Western Cape government was going to put just over 8 million rand into the farm to develop it. We had markets overseas. We had packing facilities. We're going to uplift the workers. We already had some of them trained as managers and foremen. It would have taken us about 5 years to complete the project before we handed over the other 49% to them as well. This was conveyed to APSA on the day before we signed the trust agreements and put everything into place. The money would have come from Mr. Dudley Adolf from Elsenburg. They okayed the entire project, and APSA sequestrated or liquidated the CC in which the farm was. We would have created 200 permanent jobs in the Ceres district, which was identified by the Western Cape government as the worst and second worst, barring George and Ceres. The whole thing was scuttled. APSA said, sorry, we're not interested. There was no risk to APSA because we had a very small bond on the farm. We would have created 200 full-time jobs. That is not the spin-offs as far as the families that would have been fed. The children in that area used to walk to school for 6 kilometers in snow in winter and in harsh sun in summer. We had the policy on that farm, none of our vehicles ever drove past a school kid coming or going to school. We had a shop on the farm where we sold groceries, essentials, to the people. Our neighbor said, sorry, it's the new South Africa, they must pay 50 rand per head, per taxi fare, for one way from the farm to Ceres at 50 rand back. That's 100 rand out of their pocket per week for one member of a family to go and buy groceries. Those people are going hungry today.
Yes, have you concluded your input, Mrs. Oberholzer? Quite the frustration and not.
APSA is not approachable. They would not even sit down to discuss anything. You know, there was no reason for them to do what they did. Absolutely none whatsoever. And on the farm where they sequestrated me, I ran a soup kitchen for 60 kids.
Of workers on the farm and community members and so on, I think has been conveyed to members. I'm looking. Am I right? So we will now engage. Right. Thank you.
Sorry, can I just say something else? I'm sorry.
You
want
to add?
We were the only farm in that entire Warmbokkerveld that had electricity, hot and cold water, in their homes, bath, a hand basin, and a flush toilet. We were frowned upon. We were told that if the laborers want to have a holiday, they must come and work for us. on the first, I think my wife mentioned it, on the first winter when they were having supposed to be holiday, they said, no, they don't want because they're going to go hungry. And was asked why. No, they don't get paid. We ended up paying them their holiday bonus and they came back to work for us. So they got double pay. We were frowned upon.
Points you've made cover various sectors, not only, of course, this one, and we will want to share this with other sister committees in Parliament, but allow us as trade and industry to engage with you on this. You're very fortunate that two of our members are also full-time members of the Portfolio Committee on Labour. It just so happens and they're here as full-time members of this committee. So let's engage. Right, there were issues around the National Credit Regulator, around the banking system, specifically APSA, etc., etc. So it's over to you, members. Is there anyone else?
Madam Chair, thank you. I don't want to get involved or really attempt to, I presume it's Mr. Oberholzer, yes. The author. On the last part of the presentation, but on the case law ruling on debt review, I would say that the NCR does actually have a history of intimidating and even abusing private practitioners when they even spoke out about African banks reckless lending. And it would be contrary to the principles of our constitutional democracy to attempt to stifle those like you, Mrs. Oberholzer, who speak out and who attempt to hold public bodies to accountable. That's my
opinion. Right. Are there any other comments from members or questions? I think the reason Mr. and Mrs. Oberholzer came here was to do with the bill itself, you know, debt relief or the amendment to the National Credit Act from a consumer point of view and the challenges under the Act which are being experienced. They have already welcomed the bill on the table as possibly legislation that may address some of the areas that the National Credit Act could not address. Thirdly, they have pointed out the need, as other presenters and stakeholders have, the need for a highly resourced National Credit Regulator. I think that's come through as well. But also the need for other stakeholders in the bank, in the banking industry, for example, to take a more constructive approach to the matter. So a number of issues have come up. The labour issues, which are not directly under this committee, have also been referred to. But I think most members would say and share with me, as happened in finance when we were co-chairing there, and we were at that meeting, and some of you who were there will recall, the same points were made, that it is unfortunate that you've had this experience, yes, and that this bill seeks to address some of these. But of course, we are relying on stakeholders to enable us to craft a more robust piece of legislation. So different gaps and challenges have been identified. So we would hope that you would watch the space with interest and, be able to assess whether we have, as a committee, been able to address the gaps that you yourself, as a consumer, have suffered under. I think that's really, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. I think that one of the things that was highlighted to us was the viciousness at which banks act against people. And I've also not experienced it personally, but some of my constituents have had all sorts, you know, they missed one payment and suddenly their house is on auction, and there's all sorts of these things. And I think that that's important, that it was highlighted here today. And trust us, we know, and we will be following it up, not only the, you know, the other things that you mentioned about the NCR, we'll follow that up as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Yes, Mr. Oberholster.
Can I just say something, Lady Chair, that the debt review, which she went under, never missed a payment, and it was 8G that was written. It was never the intention, but still the courts have granted sequestration. Where does she stand in that? She's a law-abiding citizen. She went according to the law. She went for protection from the law, but she did not get protection from the law. And it was a loophole that was misused by a certain law firm to interpret it as, and it says in there, the wording, specific wording is, cannot pay, over indebted. But cannot pay, meaning I am insolvent. But in her case, she was not, and that has gone before the court, that she was not insolvent, not factually nor commercially, and it was Judge Henny. In his court case, he specified that she was not factually or commercially insolvent, and has been plugged, that loophole, or the misinterpretation was plugged just after she was sequestrated with 8A. Now, she's the innocent party in this, and this is the point that I'd like to make, is with a bill that is not properly written, with a possible loophole or a possible misinterpretation, and that is what I ask, is to maybe have very carefully look at everything from all points of view, and especially the illiterate people. I'm not saying race or sex or whatever, but people that hasn't got the guts and the gumption like her to fight it for 5 years.
African, even with a matric or a degree, can understand some of our legislation. So let's be clear on that one. But fortunately, some of us in this committee were present during the financial, you know, the transformation of finance during that period, and you were there again. And certainly one would take that into account and ask staff to give us a copy of the judgment. You know, we can get access to that so that we can study it, so that this kind of mistake which the judge pointed out does not persist in our system. And you know, we did try, both the chairperson of the Standing Committee on Finances, you know, myself as chairperson of this committee, to try and get you some redress. And I think that you could perhaps brief one of our members of staff in writing, or ourselves, as to, it sounds like you did not obtain, you weren't successful in the pursuit of that, notwithstanding the different avenues we advise that you pursue. So we will look at that and try to ascertain if anything more can be done. That's all we can say, you know. I don't want to enter into a dialogue, you see, Ms. Oberholster. Honourable Esterhazen?
Yes, it's scary, and I think you must take special note. Debt review, it's very scary that we're looking at this bill and we hear from the bank's presentation and even from their legal representation that loans are not, is rearranged. A 2 year loan is now over 20 or 25 years, and the Dublin rule that states in the financial falls away. If a person like Mr. Wilber was saying now religiously pays his monthly installments and he's never in default, it doesn't work. This work individual will have to pay 1 million, 2 million rand for his 50 or 100,000 rand loan. And that's what we cannot accept in this bill.
I took it to the Supreme Court of Appeal, and this Judge Henny would not sign off. And I had email after email from my attorney in Bloemfontein saying, you've got to get the stuff. I had the transcripts, because that's what the Supreme Court still asked for, and he said they're going to dismiss it if you do not get that signed off. I have email after email to get this judgment signed off. And do you know, it took him 4 months. The Supreme Court of Appeal dismissed my case. It wasn't heard because the judge didn't sign off.
Holster, what we're going to do, those three, just reiterate that in a short email to us, you know, the Trade and Industry Committee, and we shall pursue this with the Department of Justice as well to clarify this. We are intent on, through our mandate, trying to bring about justice in this regard and fair practice. And I do know you must be extremely frustrated.
I'm very patient.
You are indeed, and probably your determination finally will be rewarded. But this is the kind of thing, and I'm glad some of the stakeholders who were here this morning continue to be present. You can see now, when we hear about these good, you know, positive stories from the banks, now we hear something else. I mean, you can all hear that. So it's not all, you know, green in the financial institutions. And there is a need for the committee to be cognizant of this. On the other hand, it does not mean that every single financial institution is to blame. So yes, there has to be a balance in this regard.
May I just say something else?
Yes, we do want to close off this, Abba
Hofstra. 1 minute. I then went to the Constitutional Court. I got it in black and white. It was taken in on the 2nd of February 2015 and dismissed. And apparently 11 judges looked at it. So the day mine went in, 11 judges looked at it, and it normally takes 3 months for a case to be heard. I find it hard to believe.
Before I can comment, I would need to look at it. You see, I have learned to my cost that shooting from the hip with my comments can be dangerous. I would like to study it.
Okay.
And so
but
you make these
to
things
you?
Available.
To you.
And
to
we
your
will
email.
Be, you know, trying to pursue it. Thank you, Mr.
To your email. Hofstra.
Well, to, you know, to myself, to Mr. Hermans, he is, after all, and Mr. Medema, they are the committee secretaries.
Fine. I will send
you
it.
See.
I will
thank you very much. And thank you for both coming here today. And all of you, there is one thing that if, let's see who it was. Yes, the National Clothing Retail Federation. Is someone here? Right. One of the issues that one would like to raise with you there is every one doesn't have to get a card FICA that is an ordinary retail card. Is that correct? Now, the Hansard doesn't accept nodding. Can't, you know, it needs to be spoken into.
Try this one. The retail store card doesn't need to be FICA'd. That's correct.
And then, however, a credit card that some retail shops or, in, you know, corporations and firms offer must be.
For a
credit card.
A credit card,
yes.
Which does need to be FICA'd because it uses a banking license.
Yeah, that, you know, you have Edcon here. You have Mr. Price, you've got Woolworths Financial Services. Seeing as you are representing such clients, you may encourage them to actually do an investigation into their records and systems. I have complaints sitting in my office where clients of theirs have been asked to FICA their ordinary cards, never having taken out a credit card with them. And every 5 minutes they are threatened by a phone that they're going to be suspended. They've gone into these financial houses or the account section of the respective entities, and it's sorted out. It's sorted out half a dozen times, and it continues. So clearly, their records leave a lot to be desired. So my advice to you, seeing as you are representing them, is to send out a stern letter asking all of your clients, etc., to review the systems that they are using. Thank you very much there. Yes, was that a hand, Honourable? No, it wasn't. It was probably an indication that we need to adjourn, and I don't blame you. Right. Members, we are going to adjourn, but as members have been informed, we are going to be getting SMSs, is that right, Mr. Hermans, about what will be taking place tomorrow. And I'm sure by now you've all got an SMS, am I right? No. Yes, there we are, the back row saying yes. Has everyone here got one? Yes. Well then, on that note, on that note, we are adjourning. Thank you.
Thank you.